My name is Naveen Varma. I'm a neurologist in the community. I was elected by yourselves. Thank you for the honor to serve. As colleagues, we've come together yet again to learn, and I think this demonstrates the beauty of medicine in many ways. We are all humble enough to still want to learn, and we don't learn for our own sake, we learn for our patients' sake. So I applaud our profession and our collegiality that this conference really represents. So thank you all for attending. I have a few announcements. When you leave here at the end of the morning, they'll be setting up for lunch. So please take all your stuff. If you do leave your stuff, we'll try and collect it, but you don't want to be waiting in line afterwards trying to find, that's my computer. No, that's not my computer. So please do take all your stuff as you leave. Dr. Epperle, who will be giving a talk later this morning, has a book called Fractured America's Broken Healthcare System, which he'll be available for signing after the lecture at about 1:30. So if you want to get a hold of that, that'll be helpful. I think since I've been coming to this conference, I've been amazed at the speakers and the quality of the speakers and learned tremendous and always wanted to have more information afterwards. So I hope you will be inspired likewise. Tonight, we will be having McKay D. Hospital. We'll be sponsoring the Dinosaur Night. So please bring your families out and come on out and join us for that. Tomorrow, Ogden Regional Medical Center will be having a reception. And at that reception, alas for you guys, when they asked me to do this, when the board gave me the details, they said, I get to give my personality to this. So you will be exposed to the Divya School of Dance for Indian dance and some Indian music. So hopefully you can join us for that reception that Ogden Regional is setting up for us. When I talk to my patients, I never quite say that golf is a sport, but I guess some people believe that. And apparently there are still availabilities for the golf game on Saturday, the nine-hole golf tournament. Friday. Please do sign up for that if that is of interest to you. I'm using my cell phone right now. You guys should not. Please turn it down to vibration, set it to mute. I know what it feels like to be tethered. I know how secure it feels to be tethered, but you know, we need to listen today. I do want to thank the Ogden Clinic, the Utah Academy of Family Physicians, the National Kidney Foundation of Utah and Idaho. They've been partnering with us for some time, and they have again partnered with us this year to help bring this on, and we appreciate their support. This is the 12th year that Weber State has joined us, and today we have Dr. Michael Vaughn as a kickoff speaker. Dr. Vaughn is the provost of Weber State University. He was previously the dean at the John B. Goddard School of Business and Economics with a research interest in antitrust enforcement. We don't think about those things, do we? He has consulted with publicly traded corporations as well as government agencies, including the Federal Trade Commission, presently serves on several corporate and nonprofit boards, earned his doctorate at the University of Nebraska, completed a postdoctoral fellowship at Princeton University with a program funded by the Pew Trust Charitable Foundation. Please welcome him as we ask him to start the program.
Good morning. It's both a pleasure and an honor to be invited to come here and welcome you to this conference. I'm delighted to be here with you this morning. I thought I would tell you a couple of things that are going on at the Weber State University campus. As a public institution, what we do should be connected with Ogden and the broader community. And if it's not connected, we're doing something wrong. So I thought I would just let you know about a couple of things that have been occupying our attention. This is the 125th anniversary for Weber State University, and we've had a number of events to commemorate that anniversary. A couple of weeks ago, we had really our biggest event of the year, and that's our commencement ceremony. And in a group this large, I would assume perhaps someone was there, but maybe I'm wrong, but did anyone attend the Weber State University commencement or one of our commencements this year? Raise your hand if you did. No. Oh, I see a hand. Okay. Commencement is a celebration of what the graduates have accomplished, but for me and my position as provost, it's also kind of a visual representation for me of what's going on campus. So it's really kind of a reality check with regard to the graduates that we're producing. And one of the things that I do at the individual commencement ceremonies is shake the hands of the graduates. And typically, I ask the graduates one or two questions. And it's amazing what you can learn just in that brief amount of time when you're shaking someone's hand. So one of my typical questions is, what are you going to do next? What's next for you? Or I sometimes ask, what did you think of your program? And this year, I was at the College of Business commencement, and I was shaking the graduates' hands. And the College of Business has quite a large group of graduates from Asian countries. So I was greeting these graduates. Quite a number of the graduates were from China. And as I shook their hand, they would tell me, for the most part, that they planned on going on to graduate school somewhere. That was a typical aspiration for these students. Then I encountered this student that looked a little older, and my assumption was it was a Japanese student. And I asked this student, what do you plan to do after graduation? And it seemed that he didn't quite understand me. So I repeated the question. He didn't understand. I asked the student then simply, what's your major? What are you getting a degree in? He didn't seem to understand that question. So I thought, this is really odd, but it's apparent to me that this student's skills in English are extremely limited. In fact, I don't think the student can speak English at all. But then we went on, and I continued to shake hands. But at the end of the ceremony, I called the dean over and called a couple of the faculty over, and I said, I know for this student, English was this student's second language, but how in the world did this student manage to get through your program and not be able to speak a word of English? And they struggle with that a bit, and then one of the faculty came up and enlightened the provost. And what had happened was the student that was graduating was from Japan, but in order to honor his father, he had asked his father to wear the cap and gown and to receive the diploma on his behalf. So the person that I was speaking to literally did not speak a word of English. And now I'm feeling really stupid because I'm torturing this father who the son wanted to honor. But that's one of the things that takes place at commencement. The other thing that I'm always conscious about is just the relative size of the different commencement ceremonies. This year we awarded almost 5,000 degrees. So largest number of degrees ever awarded at Weber State University. And one of the astonishing things for me is that 30% of those degrees were in health professions. And that's a big number. And the trend there is really astonishing because 5 years ago, that number would have been 25%. And 10 years ago, that number would have been 17%. So we're seeing tremendous growth in the health professions. And that 30% number actually understates the proportion of our students that will ultimately work in one of the medical fields, because that number is only the College of Health Professions. We also have a College of Science, excellent College of Science, and I believe on Friday we're going to do a groundbreaking ceremony for a new science building on campus. So if anyone would like to attend that groundbreaking along with the governor, we'd be delighted to have you there. But a very large proportion of our science students have an intention of going into medical school. So they're pre-med students. So the numbers actually higher. So to put this in perspective, I came to Weber State University in 1981, and as I look at number of faculty, number of graduates, size of budget, in 1981, I thought Weber State was a respectably sized university, and it was. But if I were to take the proportion of Weber State University today that is devoted to the health professions, it's larger than the entirety of Weber State University back in 1981. So again, just tremendous growth in the health professions. More students for Weber State also means more faculty. So one of the things that we've been involved with this year and last year is recruiting faculty. So over the past 2 years, we've recruited over 100 new faculty members to Weber State. And one of the things that we face when we go out and recruit new faculty members is we almost always go out of state. It's really just the nature of higher education. We recruit a very, very small fraction of our faculty members from in-state. We recruit the majority of our faculty members from out of state, some of those faculty members internationally. I just looked at the list of faculty members we had hired during the past year because you see curious things. The single largest feeder state for Weber State University this year was Ohio. And that simply reflects the fact that Ohio State University is a very big university, and this year we happened to hire a large number of faculty members from Ohio. One of the things we do when we recruit faculty from out of state is we have to sell the region. So a lot of the people that come in for interviews are like I was 30-some years ago. When I came here to interview at Weber State University, I had never spent an overnight trip in Utah. I'd been to the Salt Lake Airport but never gotten out of the airplane. So this was my first trip to Utah. And people that are coming to Utah for the first time really don't know a lot about what to expect. So they see some things that are attractive and make it easy for us to recruit them. The single biggest, I think, factor that makes it easy for us to recruit is the scenic beauty of Ogden, that we're flanked by a beautiful mountain to the north, a beautiful mountain to the east. If they're snow covered, they're, I think, in my opinion, particularly beautiful. The mountains give us incredible recreational opportunities. When I came here, I never skied. Now I'm an avid skier and ski 15, 20 times a year. I'd never mountain biked, and now that's one of my favorite sports. So when we recruit faculty, that's a really big selling point. I think that's apparent to everyone. I think everyone gets the fact that this is a beautiful place to live. One of the things that I think people don't recognize about Ogden, and I think it's underappreciated, is that Ogden is increasingly, kind of a cool place to live. And let me tell you a couple of recruiting stories that illustrate that point. I was home one Friday evening, and I got a text with a photo attached to it. And it was the chair of our economics department, Doris Guida Stevenson, and she sent me a photo and said, "Look who I'm with." And it was a picture of Doris and Christine Lagarde. And most of you here may not know who Christine Lagarde is, but she was the Minister of Finance in France for a number of years. Speculation was that she was going to run for president of France, but she took a little different direction. She's now head of the International Monetary Fund. And Forbes recently ranked her as one of the 8th most powerful people in the world. So she texted me this picture of our economics chair and Christine Lagarde, and I said, "Are you at a conference somewhere?" Because I assumed she was at a conference. She goes, "No, I'm in a bar down on 25th Street. She was actually at McCool's, and she walked in the door, and because she's an economist, she recognized Christine Lagarde and said, "What are you doing in Ogden?" And her response was, "I heard this was a pretty good place to ski." Different story. We recently recruited a faculty member away from Colorado State University. And Colorado is also a pretty nice place to live. The reason we were able to recruit this faculty member is because she had made trips to the Sundance Film Festival for the past 5 years. So she had been in the Piri Egyptian Theater just to our south. She was an avid film buff and thought it would be really neat to work in the same town that has the Sundance Film Festival every year. So just a couple of examples. I think Ogden is viewed by outsiders as something of a cool place to live, and as people that have lived here for some period of time, we may not realize that. Again, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to welcome you this morning. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to meet some new people, and I hope you have a pleasant and productive conference. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Dr. Robert Waymond. Dr. Waymond received a bachelor's degree from Weber State University and is MD from the University of Utah School of Medicine. Completed his urology residency at Southern Illinois University School of Medicine. Dr. Waymond was raised on a family's dairy farm in Warren and enjoys spending time with his wife and four children. Dr. Waymond.
All right, good morning. I'm probably going to stand over here so I can use the laser pointer and point at the screen. We've got a mic here. So again, I'm Rob Wayman. Thanks for the introduction, Dr. Varma, and go Wildcats. So I'm a local guy and happy to be practicing here at the Ogden Clinic. And what better topic than what's new in urology? So I don't know if everybody agrees. I sure love what I do. We handle a lot of things medically. We handle a lot of things surgically. And so in preparing for this talk, I really tried to look into things that are not only interesting, but things that I think would be valuable for you as you think about referring patients to a urologist. So Dr. Varma touched on a bunch of this. This is kind of my background. I do enjoy working here in Ogden at the Ogden Clinic. Just a little outline of what we're going to cover. Again, I just tried to pick some relevant topics and things that were new that maybe not everybody's familiar with, or maybe you hear on the news or on the TV. So we'll talk about BPH and some of the new options for treatment, Peyronie's disease, which is never fun to talk about, prostate cancer. We'll spend a little time talking about that. Been doing some visits to see some primary care providers, and you know, there's a lot of questions about PSA screening. We'll talk about robotic partial nephrectomy and a couple of treatments for incontinence and overactive bladder. So just a little bit about the pathophysiology of BPH. Most people are probably pretty familiar with this, but as we age, unfortunately, a lot of us are going to have some enlargement in the prostate. And as that happens, we get obstructive symptoms. So our stream slows down. When I say our, not meaning my, but ours in general as men. Our stream slows down. We find a little start and stop to our stream. It's harder to empty, and we don't always void to completion. So over time, the bladder is muscle, like any other muscle in the body. And as that muscle has to work hard to push the urine out, that's going to get thicker and stronger. And so that kind of goes against what the bladder is meant to do. The bladder is meant to relax, have high compliance, and hold large volumes of urine at low pressure. And so as that happens, we build frequency, urgency, and waking up at night. And those irritative symptoms are the most common symptoms to bring a man in to see the urologist about his prostate. So we see different treatment options here. So our alpha blockers work here at the bladder, neck, and in the prostate. 5-alpha reductase inhibitors actually shrink the prostate, so they work on the static portion of obstruction, and these work on the dynamic portion. And then also phosphodiesterase inhibitors like daily Cialis is advertised for BPH treatment. So we have these medical therapies, and if those don't work or a patient chooses to move forward for another reason, we go on to surgical therapy. So transurethral microwave therapy of the prostate is still used a lot. I've never actually done that. The data on that is that men who are well controlled with medical therapy and they want to get off the medicine, that's the patient who's appropriate for microwave therapy. Otherwise, it's not really appropriate for men who are not controlled with medicine. So then there's green light lasers, and then there's the new button TURP that we'll talk a little bit about today. So one of these alpha blockers are used for BPH as well as other urologic applications. So it's kind of the first line therapy for BPH. It's used somewhat off-label as medical expulsive therapy for ureteral calculi, and also off-label for women with voiding obstruction and dysfunction. So we'll talk a little bit about this newer drug here. It's cilodicin, or Rapaflow, and the thing that makes it unique is it's selective. So these are in vitro studies, but the alpha-1A, which is the receptors found in the genitourinary tract as opposed to in the vascular tract, it's uniquely selective, and the binding affinity, again, for prostatic tissue is very high. So that gives us the chance to have it be very well tolerated. We can use it safely with antihypertensives as well as with phosphodiesterase inhibitors as far as for treatment for men with BPH. So we don't want to see this truck parked out front. That means that the non-invasive or the conservative measures have failed. So I get patients come in and they say, "Doc, I think I need the Roto-Rooter." And so we know that they're talking about a TURP. And so TURP traditionally has been a great procedure. It has a high degree of success in treating men with large prostates and voiding dysfunction. So some of the newer technology we have is that we use bipolar energy. So that takes us away from sterile water or glycine, where we worry about TUR syndrome or dilutional hyponatremia during the procedure. So that allows us to resect for longer periods of time and take out more tissue. Well, there's a new technology, this button electrode. So this takes bipolar energy and puts it in, instead of having a loop where I'm resecting the tissue, I've actually got this little button applicator where it gets rubbed along the tissue and it vaporizes and coagulates simultaneously, which decreases the level of bleeding, allows for better visualization and treatment of the prostate during the procedure. We have, of course, like I said, with the bipolar energy, decreased risk of TUR syndrome, and we also end up having a shorter catheterization time and shorter hospital time, because of the higher degree of coagulation with the procedure. So this is just a little video just kind of showing how it works as one of the treatment options for BPH. So this is that's the bladder neck in the prostatic urethra, and this is the bipolar button electrode. And so as you can see, boy, it has an economy of motion. You can resect as you retract and as you push the probe forward, and I don't know how many of you have been in on a TURP, but there's usually a significant amount of bleeding. Now, granted, this is a video put out by the manufacturer, so it's a pretty small prostate, and it's as ideal as you can imagine it being. But that is one of the newer technologies that allows us to effectively treat BPH surgically. So next, Peyronie's disease. Peyronie's disease, of all the things that we treat, can have a huge psychological impact on both the patient and their spouse, and can be very distressing to them. So a little bit about the etiology for priapism is that usually it's been from some type of unrecognized trauma to the penis during intercourse or during some kind of sporting activity or whatever it may be, that in response to that trauma, we get plaque formation. This is a non-expansile thickening or plaque of the connective tissue surrounding the corporal bodies or the erectile bodies called the tunica albuginea. And it's compared largely to the contractures you'd find with Dupuytren's disease. So it presents with pain with erection and, of course, penile curvature and even sexual dysfunction. Now, these curvatures are so significant that it prohibits intercourse. So traditionally, treatment has been medical therapy, and medical therapy may slow the disease, but it doesn't ever reverse it or actually cure the disease. And so there are different things that we can put patients on. One of the newer treatments is a verapamil injection, and that's where in the clinic you take a verapamil and you take a fairly good-sized needle and you do multiple punctures into the plaque itself, kind of the Swiss cheese approach, and inject verapamil, and it's been shown to be somewhat efficacious in treating and relaxing that plaque over time. Any of the guys out there, I know that doesn't sound fun to have lots of needle pokes in the clinic, but it's definitely a treatment option. And then surgical options, plication. Anytime you've got a bend on one side, if you shorten up the other side, you can straighten out that that bend. Grafting by removing the plaque and putting in another amount of another type of tissue as a graft, or even lithotripsy in the past has been used to treat Peyronie's disease. The problem with any of those is there's potential for either erectile dysfunction with grafting or shortening of the penis with plication. So one of the newer treatments, and again, this is a drug name. I know we have to be careful with putting drug names up there, but it's the only it's the only drug in its class, so felt it appropriate to put it up there as recognizable. So Xiaflex was originally FDA approved to treat Dupuytren's. And just recently, this last year, the FDA has approved it to treat Peyronie's disease. So it's still not very common in Utah. There's only a couple of people that are doing it on somewhat of a trial basis here, one guy at the university and one guy down in Salt Lake. And that is injection into the plaque along with modeling afterwards. The initial data shows approximately a 35% improvement across the board in patients. And again, we're not looking to make things exactly straight, but just to make it usable for the patient. Potential side effects are, of course, anytime you use a collagenase, you're worrying about too much softening of the tissue. So in the modeling process, you can have hematoma, pain, swelling, and there are even a few reports of corporal rupture that is a pretty significant complication. And of course, it's fairly costly. It takes multiple injections. So now, hot ticket item about prostate cancer screening. So, you know, there's a lot of cancers out there that we screen for, but the data for prostate cancer after we started screening is pretty significant. Do we save lives by screening for prostate cancer? You bet we do. And it's made a significant change since we started PSA screening back in the early 90s. And so what's kind of led us to the point we are today is that with this screening tool, anybody and everybody was getting a biopsy, and whoever was found to have a cancer was getting treatment. And that's something that we've come to learn more and more about prostate cancer over time, as we've always known it's been kind of a slow cancer, and you've got a range from high grade to low grade and different behaviors or characteristics of the cancer. But we've never been sure, so always play it safe, and the patients have always been treated. And so we know recently the Preventive Task Force Service is even recommended against PSA screening, and they run that on the basis of over-treatment of disease and the significant quality of life complications or side effects of treatment. And so there's been some changes in screening recommendations, and so I'll tell you that not all prostate cancers are slow growing and people still die of prostate cancer. And a lot of the data that they use about mortality rates from prostate cancer, they don't count guys who are living with metastatic disease and are undergoing long-term treatment. They don't fall into those mortality numbers, but they're still there. And so the AUA has modified their prostate cancer screening or PSA screening recommendations. The best bang for your buck for prostate cancer screening is between the years of 55 and 70. Okay, before 55, they recommend that men with increased risk factors, including family history or race, any other abnormal voiding dysfunction that may lead you to believe that they have some kind of issue with malignancy, are guys that would be screened before that time. And afterwards, we always look to a 10 to 15 year life expectancy. And with our aging population, man, more and more of these older guys that come to my clinic are at, you know, I hope I look half as good as they do at age 75. So there are still guys who are getting screening. As I talk to people to my referring physicians in the community, most people are still screening. Most people are still screening after age 50. And to tell you the truth, until we learn more about that or have better data, I'm still recommending the same myself. And I think that my couple words on PSA itself, PSA is a very good test. We know it's not a one-to-one relationship. Not everybody with an elevated PSA has prostate cancer. We know that. But when used appropriately, it's still a very effective screening tool. And we are using other things like PSA velocity or the rate of change and percent-free PSA to help really stratify risk and decide who needs a biopsy and who doesn't. But in the end, you know, if we're worried, the biopsy is the only way to really know if somebody's got a cancer. So overall, I still recommend, and the AUA still recommends, screening for prostate cancer with PSA. So also along with this is that we're trying to decide who really needs treatment and what other good treatment options are available for a man with a small amount of low risk or low grade disease. So active surveillance. I've been practicing here in Ogden for 4 years, and I've got a half a dozen guys who've been on active surveillance for prostate cancer for about 4 years, and they're doing very well, and they've been able to safely avoid a treatment and the associated side effects of treatment without increasing their risk for mortality from their disease. So for active surveillance, we use some inclusion criteria. This data originally all came out of Canada, right? So if you get diagnosed with a cancer in Canada, you get on the waiting list, and when your number comes up, you can get treatment. So they had all these men who were waiting around with a diagnosis of prostate cancer who hadn't had treatment. And so they thought, why don't we follow these guys and see how they do without treatment? So that's where we get our initial active surveillance data. And so the inclusion criteria for active surveillance are a low stage, less than a T2A disease. That's a small palpable disease. PSA less than 10, of course, low-grade disease with a Gleason 6 or less. Less than or equal to 3 positive cores. And there's some varying recommendations on how much cancer you can have in each biopsy core. So data here supporting the fact that active surveillance is safe would be that these men, 77% of men at 5 years were still on active surveillance. They hadn't had disease progression to take them off. 62% at 10 years. And of course, no one had died of their disease undergoing active surveillance. Okay, and we see trends over time that men who are eligible for active surveillance, in 2011, the last number was nearly 20% of men were actually choosing to undergo active surveillance. So again, the take-home point about active surveillance is men with low-grade disease, small-volume disease, who may likely represent over-diagnosis and would represent over-treatment if they had active treatment. So the idea is to watch them close enough that we avoid treatment without letting the disease get out of hand. So at the point they did need treatment, that they wouldn't have a less efficacious outcome, or they wouldn't have a poor outcome from a disease-specific survival. Okay, so for years, urologists have been saying, I wish I knew exactly which cancers were going to be a bad actor and which cancers were going to be acceptable to watch. And so we've got some of that information now. So this new test, the Prolaris test, it's from a local company, Myriad Genetics, and it uses genetic testing to stratify the aggressive nature of prostate cancer. So classically, for urologists, we use this DiAMICO risk classification. That takes the stage of the cancer, the grade of the cancer, and the PSA level. And we combine those to give a patient, to classify them as low, moderate, or high-risk disease. But with some of this newer data, we see that if this is all the men who had moderate risk or Gleason 7 cancer, there are going to be some men that have a cancer that's less aggressive or equivalent to a low-grade cancer, and some men who, with the same AUA risk classification, would have a very significant or high-risk cancer. And so this just gives us one more thing to help us treat patients appropriately by stratifying their risk for progression of disease. Yeah? No, that's a genetic test on the biopsy tissue. Yep. And so if a patient enters there, or we want to use that test, we take the tissue from the pathology lab where it was studied, send it down there, and they run genetic testing on it. Yep. And so right now I'm actually entering patients in a trial for that, and the trial is based on, is this going to be clinically significant? So we have a patient come in, they get entered into the trial, and we say, before we know what the trial results are, what was our treatment decision? And then we get the results and we see if that impacted our final treatment decision. So tests like this that are genetic and may cost some, may have a high cost to them, we want to know if it's going to actually impact patient care before we subject patients to those tests. So Now we're going to talk a little bit about metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. So prostate cancer, we know we can cure it with surgery or with radiation, but if a guy presents with locally advanced or metastatic disease, or if he has recurrent disease after treatment, what are our options? So traditionally, we had Lupron. We had either surgical castration or medical castration. And after that, so if we look at our curve here, so we've got local therapy, we have a PSA recurrence, and we undergo this hormone therapy or medical or surgical castration. And after that point, if we start to have another PSA recurrence, then what are our options? In the past, we used to just have chemotherapy, and no one ever really did that well with chemotherapy. So now we've got this Provenge, which is an immunotherapy, and again, I use its name and its data because it's the only drug in its class. And so the way it works is we take the patient's cells, and they're sent away and they're modified. And so you have an antigen-presenting cell, and we take this prostatic acid phosphatase. That's an antigen present on virtually all prostate cancer. And so we combine it with that antigen-presenting cell, which matures, and then it's given back to the patient. And so that antigen-presenting cell presents it to T cells, and then these activated T cells can help fight the cancer. And so it's a novel method to actually improve prostate cancer therapy. So the survival data or survival benefit shows a pretty significant survival. And of course, in the first year, it's not a lot different with or without it because men are still in the lower stages of disease. But as they progress, it's actually been found to be significantly effective for patients. The problem is with it, it's very high cost, and so that's again something that we're careful to use in the right patients. A couple of other things, again, drug names, sorry about that, but these are the only two in their class. This is, again, treatment for castrate-resistant prostate cancer. So if we go back here, at this point, before we get to chemotherapy, what do we have? And so these two drugs, this one is an anti-androgen, if you would. It blocks biosynthesis of androgen at the testicle, the adrenal gland, and as well as the cancer itself. Because, you know, if we stop, take away the testosterone, then why do these cancers progress over time? Because they become, you know, independent and produce their own androgen. So that's basis behind this therapy. And this one is an androgen receptor blocker, and it performs at multiple levels within the cell to stop androgen use within the prostate cancer cell. We're going to talk a little bit about robotic-assisted laparoscopic partial nephrectomy. So more and more we find earlier stage renal cell carcinoma because CT scan is so highly used. And so in the past, our goal has always been to save kidneys whenever we can. And so for the appropriate tumors, we do a partial nephrectomy. Before, it was either only the best laparoscopic guys who had the most skills who could do it. It was kind of a long, painful procedure because you've had intracorporeal suturing. But now, with robotic assistance, we've got these wristed motions, and we've got better imaging and better visualization. So this is a tumor, and with robotic assistance, this tumor is just being resected. And so as you can see, after ultrasound imaging intraoperative to check out the depth of the tumor, the robotic scissors can slowly resect this tumor and save more kidneys by doing so. So obviously, kidneys get 20% of the blood flow all the time, so the reason this isn't just spurting blood everywhere is that there's warm ischemia happening. There's a clamp on the renal artery. So whenever we do this, our goal is to get that tumor out and resected and have that rhinorrhaphy or the tumor site closed with under 20 minutes. Under 30 minutes is the goal, but we always try and stay under 20 minutes clamp time. So that's new technology in urology that allows us to better treat our patients. Thought that would be interesting for people to just see how it happens. So, and that's something that we're doing here in Ogden to treat our patients. Okay, stress incontinence, so intrinsic sphincter deficiency. So in the past to treat this, this is termed lead pipe urethra. It's diagnosed as a low leak point pressure where it doesn't take much for a lady to leak. She could bend over or just lift something or do anything and or even leak all the time because she has not only urethral hypermobility, but she has problems at her sphincter. She has deficiency at the sphincter. So to treat that, in the past, we'd use a bovine collagen, and we'd inject it to bulk up the urethra, and patients would do fantastic. But we know that the body breaks down collagen, and so over time, this would go away. So one of the newer technologies we have is this coaptite, and this is, this is calcium hydroxyapatite, same thing found in bones and teeth, and so it's very well accepted by the body. It's in a saline gel, and it's injected in the urethra to bulk it up. So here's a diagram or a cartoon to represent that transurethrally, a needle's put into the submucosal tissue, and this bulking is performed. There's a before and after, and it's very effective at treating incontinence in ladies who present with intrinsic sphincter deficiency or who have repeat or recurrent incontinence despite urethral sling placement. So again, the reason it lasts is that it gets injected and stands as a scaffold or a matrix where the tissue can grow in, so it's more of a permanent fix. Again, only drug in its class, that's why it's up there. So traditionally for overactive bladder, it's a game changer for women or for men. It's a big quality of life issue with frequency and urgency, always looking for a bathroom, even leaking because of overactive bladder. So traditionally we've always had anticholinergics, and they're great drugs, and the newer drugs have fewer side effects, but we still have side effects associated with them. So one of the newer options we have is instead of an anticholinergic or an antimuscarinic, we have a beta agonist. So these beta-3 adrenergic receptors in the bladder, this drug, mirabegron, actually acts at these receptor sites to relax the detrusor, decrease symptomatology, and facilitate filling and storage of urine within the bladder. So it's a very... You know, even in some of the older patients who we worry about CNS side effects of the antimuscarinics, it's a very effective treatment for them. Okay, and the last we're going to just finish up with Botox in the bladder. So we have patients that, despite our best efforts, still have such severe symptoms from an overactive bladder that the medical therapy or oral medical therapy is not sufficient. So Botox, we know that, I don't know if Dr. Tingey is going to talk anything about Botox as a dermatologist, but it's been used for cosmetic reasons or for contractures or whatever. Well, guess what? We can use it in the bladder. So traditionally, when it was first used, it was for patients with a spinal cord injury or a neurogenic reason to have a bad bladder, and it was very effective. So over time, we received FDA approval to use it in the bladder for overactive bladder that's refractory to medical therapy, okay? And so this is a kind of a sample of how it's injected. There are 20 to 30 injection sites within the bladder, and it's very efficacious. It has great results for patients and really improves quality of life. We've got reduced episodes of incontinence. It's effective for approximately, give or take 10 months, depending on the patient. And overall, important application of Botox for patients with overactive bladder. So I think that's the end of the talk. I'm open for any questions. Yes. Okay, that's a great question. So the protocol that we use, and there are different protocols around, the patient, once they have their diagnosis, for the first 2 years, they see me every 3 months with a rectal exam and a PSA test. And at any time, if we think things are changing or progressing, we do a biopsy. Regardless of change in PSA, at year one and year two, they get a repeat biopsy. Okay, and then after that, we go to every 6 months, and then without any sign of progression, they don't get another biopsy for 4 years, which would be 6 years into the treatment. So yeah, it's keeping the finger on the pulse so we don't let it get away.